Side 7, It, by Stephen King, continuing on page 229. 5. Hi-yo, Silver, away! The words came out deeper than his normal speaking voice. It was almost the voice of the man he would become. Silver gained speed slowly, the quickening clickety-clack of the bicycle playing cards clothespinned to the spokes marking the increase. Bill stood on the pedals, his hands clamped on the bike grips with the wrists turned up. He looked like a man trying to lift a stupendously heavy barbell. Cords stood out on his neck, veins pulsed in his temples. His mouth was turned down in a trembling sneer of effort as he fought the familiar battle against weight and inertia, busting his brains to get Silver moving. As always, it was worth the effort. Silver began to roll along more briskly. Houses slid past smoothly, instead of just poking by. On his left, where Kansas Street crossed Jackson, the unfettered Kanduskeag became the canal. Past the intersection, Kansas Street headed swiftly downhill toward Center and Main, Derry's business district. Streets crossed frequently here, but they were all stop-signed in Bill's favor, and the possibility that a driver might one day blow by one of those signs and flatten him to a bleeding shadow on the street had never crossed Bill's mind. It is unlikely he would have changed his ways even if it had. He might have done so either earlier or later in his life, but this spring and early summer had been a strange, thundery time for him. Ben would have been astounded if someone were to ask him if he was lonely. Bill would have been likewise astounded if someone asked him if he was courting death. Of course not, he would have responded immediately and indignantly. But that did not change the fact that his runs down Kansas Street to town had become more and more like bonsai charges as the weather warmed. This section of Kansas Street was known as Up Mile Hill. Bill took it at full speed, bent over Silver's handlebars to cut down the wind resistance, one hand poised over the cracked rubber bulb of his Ooga horn to warn the unwary, his red hair blowing back from his head in a rippling wave. The click of the playing cards had mounted to a steady roar. The effortful sneer had become a big goofball grin. The residences on the right had given way to business buildings, warehouses and meatpacking plants, most of them, which blurred by in a scary but satisfying rush. To his left, the canal was a wink of fire in the corner of his eye. "Hi-yo, Silver, away!" he screamed triumphantly. Silver flew over the first curbing, and as they almost always did at that point, his feet lost contact with the pedals. He was freewheeling, now wholly in the lap of whatever god had been appointed the job of protecting small boys. He swerved into the street, doing maybe 15 miles an hour over the posted speed of 25. It was all behind him now, his stutter, his dad's blank, hurt eyes as he puttered around his garage workshop, the terrible sight of the dust on the closed piano cover upstairs, dusty because his mother didn't play anymore. The last time had been at George's funeral. Three Methodist hymns. George going out into the rain, wearing his yellow slicker, carrying the newspaper boat with its glaze of paraffin. Mr. Gardner coming up the street 20 minutes later with his body wrapped in a blood-stained quilt. His mother's agonized shriek. All behind him. He was the Lone Ranger. He was John Wayne. He was Bo Diddley. He was anybody he wanted to be and nobody who cried and got scared and wanted his mother. Silver flew, and stuttering Bill Denbro flew with him. Their gantry-like shadow fled behind them. They raced down Up Mile Hill together. The playing cards roared. Bill's feet found the pedals again, and he began to pump, wanting to go even faster, wanting to reach some hypothetical speed, not of sound, but of memory, and crashed through the pain barrier. He raced on, bent over his handlebars. He raced to beat the devil. The three-way intersection of Kansas, Center, and Main was coming up fast. It was a horror of one-way traffic and conflicting signs and stoplights, which were supposed to be timed but really weren't. The result, a Derry News editorial had proclaimed the year before, was a traffic rotary conceived in hell. As always, Bill's eyes flicked right and left, fast, gauging the traffic flow, looking for the holes. If his judgment was mistaken, if he stuttered, you might say, he would be badly hurt or killed. He arrowed into the slow-moving traffic which clogged the intersection, running a red light and fading to the right to avoid a lumbering port-holed Buick. He shot a bullet of a glance back over his shoulder to make sure the middle lane was empty. He looked forward again and saw that in roughly 5 seconds he was going to crash into the rear end of a pickup truck that had stopped squarely in the middle of the intersection, while the Uncle Ike type behind the wheel craned his neck to read all the signs and make sure he hadn't taken a wrong turn and somehow ended up in Miami Beach. The lane on Bill's right was full of a Derry Bangor intercity bus. He slipped in that direction just the same and shot the gap between the stopped pickup and the bus, still moving at 40 miles an hour. At the last second, he snapped his head hard to one side, like a soldier doing an over-enthusiastic eyes right, to keep the mirror mounted on the passenger side of the pickup from rearranging his teeth. Hot diesel from the bus laced his throat like a kick of strong liquor. He heard a thin gasping squeal as one of his bike grips kissed a line up the coach's aluminum side. He got just a glimpse of the bus driver, his face paper white under his peaked Hudson Bus Company cap. The driver was shaking his fist at Bill and shouting something. Bill doubted it was happy birthday. Here was a trio of old ladies crossing Main Street from the New England side to the Shoeboat side. They heard the harsh burr of playing cards and looked up. Their mouths dropped open as a boy on a huge bike passed within a foot and a half of them like a mirage. The worst and the best of the trip was behind him now. He had looked at the very real possibility of his own death again, and again had found himself able to look away. The bus had not crushed him. He had not killed himself and the three old ladies with their Freese's shopping bags and their Social Security checks. He had not been splattered across the tailgate of Uncle Ike's old Dodge pickup. He was going uphill again now, speed bleeding away. Something, oh, call it desire, that was good enough, wasn't it, was bleeding away with it. All the thoughts and memories were catching up. Hi, Bill, gee, we almost lost sight of you for a while there, but here we are, rejoining him, climbing up his shirt and jumping into his ear and whooshing into his brain like little kids going down a slide. He could feel them settling into their accustomed places, their feverish bodies jostling each other. Gosh, wow, here we are inside Bill's head again. Let's think about George, okay? Who wants to start? You think too much, Bill. No, that wasn't the problem. The problem was he imagined too much. He turned into Richard's Alley and came out on Center Street a few moments later, pedaling slowly, feeling the sweat on his back and in his hair. He dismounted Silver in front of the Center Street drugstore and went inside. 6. Before George's death, Bill would have gotten the salient points across to Mr. Keene by speaking to him. The druggist was not exactly kind, or at least Bill had an idea he was not, but he was patient enough, and he did not tease or make fun. But now Bill's stutter was much worse, and he really was afraid something bad might happen to Eddie if he didn't move fast. So when Mr. Keene said, "Hello, Billy Denbro, can I help you?" Bill took a folder advertising vitamins, turned it over, and wrote on the back, "Eddie Kasprak and I were playing in the Barrens. He's got a bad asthma attack. I mean, he can hardly breathe. Can you give me a refill on his aspirator?" He pushed this note across the glass-topped counter to Mr. Keene, who read it, looked at Bill's anxious blue eyes, and said, "Of course, wait right here, and don't be handling anything you shouldn't." Bill shifted impatiently from one foot to the other while Mr. Keene was behind the rear counter. Although he was back there less than 5 minutes, it seemed an age before he returned with one of Eddie's plastic squeeze bottles. He handed it over to Bill, smiled, and said, "This should take care of the problem." "Thanks, Bill said. "I don't have any "That's all right, son. Mrs. Kasprak has an account here. I'll just add this on. I'm sure she'll want to thank you for your kindness." Bill, much relieved, thanked Mr. Keene and left quickly. Mr. Keene came around the counter to watch him go. He saw Bill toss the aspirator into his bike basket and mount clumsily. "Can he actually ride a bike that big?" Mr. Keene wondered. "I doubt it. I doubt it very much." But the Denbro kid somehow got it going without falling on his head and pedaled slowly away. The bike, which looked to Mr. Keene like somebody's idea of a joke, wobbled madly from side to side. The aspirator rolled back and forth in the basket. Mr. Keene grinned a little. If Bill had seen that grin, it might have gone a good way toward confirming his idea that Mr. Keene was not exactly one of the world's champion nice guys. It was sour, the grin of a man who has found much to wonder about, but almost nothing to uplift in the human condition. Yes, he would add Eddie's asthma medication to Sonia Kasprak's bill, and as always, she would be surprised, and suspicious rather than grateful, at how cheap the medication was. Other drugs were so dear, she said. Mrs. Kasprak, Mr. Keene knew, was one of those people who believed nothing cheap could do a person much good. He could really have soaked her for her son's hydrox mist, and there had been times when he had been tempted. But why should he make himself a party to the woman's foolishness? It wasn't as though he were going to starve. Cheap? Oh my, yes. Hydrox mist, administer as needed, typed neatly on the gummed label he pasted on each aspirator bottle, was wonderfully cheap. But even Mrs. Kasprak was willing to admit that it controlled her son's asthma quite well in spite of that fact. It was cheap because it was nothing but a combination of hydrogen and oxygen with a dash of camphor added to give the mist a faint medicinal taste. In other words, Eddie's asthma medicine was tap water. 7. It took Bill longer to get back because he was going uphill. In several places he had to dismount and push Silver. He simply didn't have the muscle power necessary to keep the bike going up more than mild slopes. By the time he had stashed his bike and made his way back to the stream, it was 4:10. All sorts of black suppositions were crossing his mind. The Hanscom kid would have deserted, leaving Eddie to die. Or the bullies could have backtracked and beaten the shit out of both of them. Or, worst of all, the man whose business was murdering kids might have gotten one or both of them, as he had gotten George. He knew there had been a great deal of gossip and speculation about that. Bill had a bad stutter, but he wasn't deaf, although people sometimes seemed to think he must be, since he spoke only when absolutely necessary. Some people felt that the murder of his brother wasn't related at all to the murders of Betty Ripsom, Cheryl LaMonica, Matthew Clements, and Veronica Grogan. Others claimed that George, Ripsom, and LaMonica had been killed by one man, and the other two were the work of a copycat killer. A third school of thought held that the boys had been killed by one man, the girls by another. Bill believed they had all been killed by the same person, if it was a person. He sometimes wondered about that, as he sometimes wondered about his feelings concerning Derry this summer. Was it still the aftermath of George's death, the way his parents seemed to ignore him now, so lost in their grief over their younger son that they couldn't see the simple fact that Bill was still alive and might be hurting himself? Those things combined with the other murders? The voices that sometimes seemed to speak in his head now, whispering to him? And surely they were not variations of his own voice, for these voices did not stutter. They were quiet, but they were sure, advising him to do certain things, but not others. Was it those things which made Derry seem somehow different now? Somehow threatening, with unexplored streets that did not invite, but seemed instead to yawn in a kind of ominous silence? That made some faces look secret and frightened? He didn't know, but he believed, as he believed all the murders were the work of a single agency, that Derry really had changed, and that his brother's death had signaled the beginning of that change. The black suppositions in his head came from the lurking idea that anything could happen in Derry now. Anything. But when he came around the last bend, all looked cool. Ben Hanscom was still there, sitting beside Eddie. Eddie himself was sitting up now, his hands dangling in his lap, head bent, still wheezing. The sun had sunk low enough to project long green shadows across the stream. "Boy, that was quick," Ben said, standing up. "I didn't expect you for another half an hour." "I got a fast bike," Bill said with some pride. For a moment, the two of them looked at each other cautiously, warily. Then Ben smiled tentatively, and Bill smiled back. The kid was fat, but he seemed okay, and he had stayed put. That must have taken some guts, with Henry and his J.D. friends maybe still wandering around out there someplace. Bill winked at Eddie, who was looking at him with dumb gratitude.
"Here you go, Eddie."
He tossed him the aspirator. Eddie plunged it into his open mouth, triggered it, and gasped convulsively. Then he leaned back, eyes shut. Ben watched this with concern.
"Geez, he's really got it bad, doesn't he?"
Bill nodded.
I was scared there for a while,
Ben said in a low voice. I was wondering what to do if he had a convulsion or something. I kept trying to remember the stuff they told us in that Red Cross assembly we had in April. All I could come up with was put a stick in his mouth so he wouldn't bite his tongue off. I think that's for epileptics.
Oh, yeah, I guess you're right.
He won't have a convulsion anyway, Bill said. That medicine will fix him right up. Look. Eddie's labored breathing had eased. He opened his eyes and looked up at them.
Thanks, Bill, he said. That one was a real pissoir.
I guess it started when they creamed your nose, huh? Ben asked. Eddie laughed ruefully, stood up, and stuck the aspirator in his back pocket.
Wasn't even thinking about my nose, was thinking about my mom.
Yeah, really? Ben sounded surprised, but his hand went to the rags of his sweatshirt and began fiddling there nervously.
She's going to take one look at the blood on my shirt and have me down to the emergency room at Dairy Home in about 5 seconds.
Why? Ben asked.
It stopped, didn't it? Gee, I remember this kid I was in kindergarten with, Scooter Morgan, and he got a bloody nose when he fell off the monkey bars. They took him to the emergency room, but only because it kept bleeding.
Yeah? Bill asked, interested. Did he die?
No, but he was out of school a week.
It doesn't matter if it stopped or not, Eddie said gloomily. She'll take me anyway. She'll think it's broken and I got pieces of bone sticking in my brain or something.
Can you get bones in your brain? Bill asked.
This was turning into the most interesting conversation he'd had in weeks.
I don't know. If you listen to my mother, you can get anything.
Eddie turned to Ben again.
She takes me down to the emergency room about once or twice a month. I hate that place. There was this orderly once. He told her they ought to make her pay rent. She was really PO'd.
Wow, Ben said. He thought Eddie's mother must be really weird. He was unconscious of the fact that now both of his hands were fiddling in the remains of his sweatshirt.
Why don't you just say no? Say something like, hey, Ma, I feel all right. I just want to stay home and watch Sea Hunt. Like that.
Eddie said uncomfortably and said no more.
You're Ben Hanscom, right?
Bill asked.
Yeah, you're Bill Denbro. Yeah, yes, and this is
Eddie Kasprak, Eddie said. I hate it when you stutter my name, Bill. You sound like Elmer Fudd.
Sahari.
Well, I'm pleased to meet you both, Ben said. It came out sounding prissy and a little lame. A silence fell amid the three of them. It was not an entirely uncomfortable silence. In it, they became friends.
Why were those guys chasing you? Eddie asked at last.
They're always chasing someone, Bill said. I hate those fuckers. Ben was silent a moment, mostly in admiration, before Bill's use of what Ben's mother sometimes called the really bad word. Ben had never said the really bad word out loud in his whole life, although he had written it, in extremely small letters, on a telephone pole the Halloween before last.
Bowers ended up sitting next to me during the exams, Ben said at last. He wanted to copy off my paper. I wouldn't let him.
You must want to die young, kid, Eddie said admiringly. Stuttering Bill burst out laughing. Ben looked at him sharply, decided he wasn't being laughed at, exactly. It was hard to say how he knew it, but he did, and grinned.
I guess I must, he said. Anyway, he's got to take summer school, and he and those other guys were laying for me, and that's what happened.
You looked like they killed you, Bill said.
I fell down here from Kansas Street, down the side of the hill.
He looked at Eddie.
I'll probably see you in the emergency room, now that I think about it. When my mom gets a look at my clothes, she'll put me there.
Both Bill and Eddie burst out laughing this time, and Ben joined them. It hurt his stomach to laugh, but he laughed anyway, shrilly and a little hysterically. Finally, he had to sit down on the bank, and the plopping sound his butt made when it hit the dirt got him going all over again. He liked the way his laughter sounded with theirs. It was a sound he had never heard before. Not mingled laughter, he had heard that lots of times, but mingled laughter of which his own was a part. He looked up at Bill Denbro, their eyes met, and that was all it took to get both of them laughing again. Bill hitched up his pants, flipped up the collar of his shirt, and began to slouch around in a kind of moody hoodie strut. His voice dropped down low, and he said,
I'm gonna kill you, kid. Don't give me no crap. I'm dumb, but I'm big. I can crack walnuts with my forehead. I can piss vinegar and shit cement. My name's Honey Bunch Bowers, and I'm the boss prick round these year dairy parts. Eddie had collapsed to the stream bank now and was rolling around, clutching his stomach and howling. Ben was doubled up, head between his knees, tears spouting from his eyes, snot hanging from his nose in long white runners, laughing like a hyena. Bill sat down with him, and little by little the three of them quieted.
"There's one really good thing about it," Eddie said presently. "If Bowers is in summer school, we won't see him much down here."
"You play in the Barrens a lot?" Ben asked. It was an idea that never would have crossed his own mind in 1,000 years, not with the reputation the Barrens had. But now that he was down here, it didn't seem bad at all. In fact, this stretch of the low bank was very pleasant as the afternoon made its slow way toward dusk.
Sure, it's neat. Mostly nobody bothers us down here. We hoof off a lot. Bowers and those other guys don't come down here anyway.
You and Eddie?
Bill
shook his head. His face knotted up like a wet dish rag when he stuttered, Ben noticed, and suddenly an odd thought occurred to him. Bill hadn't stuttered at all when he was mocking the way Henry Bowers talked.
"Richie,"
Bill exclaimed now, paused a moment, and then went on.
"Richie Tozier usually comes down, too. But him and his dad were going to clean out their,
attic," Eddie translated, and tossed a stone into the water.
Plunk. "Yeah, I know him," Ben said. "You guys come down here a lot, huh?"
The idea fascinated him and made him feel a stupid sort of longing as well.
But pretty much, Bill said. "Well, why don't you come back down tomorrow? Me and Eddie were trying to make a ham."
Ben could say nothing. He was astounded not only by the offer, but by the simple and unstudied casualness with which it had come.
"Maybe we ought to do something else," Eddie said. "The dam wasn't working so hot anyway."
Ben got up and walked down to the stream, brushing the dirt from his huge hams. There were still matted piles of small branches at either side of the stream, but anything else they'd put together had washed away.
"You ought to have some boards," Ben said. "Get boards and put them in a row, facing each other, like the bread of a sandwich."
Bill and Eddie were looking at him, puzzled. Ben dropped to one knee.
"Look," he said. "Boards here and here. You stick them in the stream bed facing each other, okay? Then before the water can wash them away, you fill up the space between them with rocks and sand."
"Well, we," Bill said.
"Huh?" "Well, we do it."
"Oh," Ben said, feeling, and looking, he was sure, extremely stupid. But he didn't care if he looked stupid because he suddenly felt very happy. He couldn't even remember the last time he felt this happy.
"Yeah, we.
Anyway, if you, we, fill up the space in between with rocks and stuff, it'll stay. The upstream board will lean back against the rocks and dirt as the water piles up. The second board would tilt back and wash away after a while, I guess. But if we had a third board, well, look." He drew in the dirt with a stick. Bill and Eddie Kasprak leaned over and studied this little drawing with sober interest.
"You ever built a dam before?" Eddie asked.
His tone was respectful, almost awed.
"Nope." "Then how do you know this will work?"
Ben looked at Bill, puzzled.
"Sure it will," he said. "Why wouldn't it?" "But how do you know?"
Bill asked. Ben recognized the tone of the question as not one of sarcastic disbelief, but honest interest.
"How can you tell?" "I just know," Ben said.
He looked down at his drawing in the dirt again as if to confirm it to himself. He had never seen a cofferdam in his life, either in diagram or in fact, and had no idea that he had just drawn a pretty fair representation of one.
"Okay,"
Bill said, and clapped Ben on the back. "So see you tomorrow."
"What time?" "Me and Eddie will get here by 8:30 or so." "If me and my mom aren't still waiting in the emergency room," Eddie said and sighed.
"I'll bring some boards," Ben said. "This old guy in the next block's got a bunch of them. I'll hawk a few."
"Bring some supplies, too," Eddie said. "Stuff to eat. You know, like sandwiches, ring-dings, stuff like that."
"Okay.
You got any guns?"
I got my Daisy air rifle, Ben said. My mom gave it to me for Christmas, but she gets mad if I shoot it off in the house.
Well, bring it to the down, Bill said. We'll play good guns, maybe.
Okay, Ben said happily. Listen, I got to split for home, you guys.
Us too, Bill said.
The three of them left the Barrens together. Ben helped Bill push Silver up the embankment. Eddie trailed behind them, wheezing again and looking unhappily at his blood-spotted shirt. Bill said goodbye and then pedaled off, shouting, "Hi-yo, Silver! Away!" at the top of his lungs.
That's a gigantic bike, Ben said.
Bet your fur, Eddie said.
He had taken another gulp from his aspirator and was breathing normally again.
He rides me double sometimes on the back. Goes so fast it just about scares the crap out of me. He's a good man, Bill is.
He said this last in an offhand way, but his eyes said something more emphatic. They were worshipful.
You know about what happened to his brother, don't you?
No. What about him?
Got killed last fall. Some guy killed him. Pulled one of his arms right off, just like pulling a wing off in a fly.
Jeez'em crow.
Bill, he used to only stutter a little. Now it's really bad. Did you notice that he stutters?
Well, a little.
But his brains don't stutter. Get what I mean?
Yeah.
Anyway, I just told you because if you want Bill to be your friend, it's better not to talk to him about his little brother. Don't ask him questions or anything. He's all frigged up about it.
Man, I would be too, Ben said.
He remembered now, vaguely, about the little kid who had been killed the previous fall. He wondered if his mother had been thinking about George Denbro when she gave him the watch he now wore, or only about the more recent killings.
Did it happen right after the big flood?
Yeah.
They had reached the corner of Kansas and Jackson, where they would have to split up. Kids ran here and there, playing tag and throwing baseballs. One dorky little kid in big blue shorts went trotting self-importantly past Ben and Eddie, wearing a Davy Crockett coonskin backward so that the tail hung down between his eyes. He was rolling a hula hoop and yelling,
hoop tag, wanna?
Idea, if you really don't want to go to the emergency room.
Oh, yeah?
Eddie looked at Ben, doubtful but wanting to hope.
You got a nickel?
I got a dime, so what?
Ben eyed the drying maroon splotches on Eddie's shirt.
Stop at the store and get a chocolate milk. Pour about half of it on your shirt. Then when you get home, tell your mama you spilled all of it.
Eddie's eyes brightened. In the 4 years since his dad had died, his mother's eyesight had worsened considerably. For reasons of vanity, and because she didn't know how to drive a car, she refused to see an optometrist and get glasses. Dried blood stains and chocolate milk stains looked about the same.
Maybe.
That might work, he said.
Just don't tell her it was my idea if she finds out.
I won't, Eddie said. See you later, alligator.
Okay.
No, Eddie said patiently. When I say that, you're supposed to say, after a while, crocodile.
Oh, after a while, crocodile.
You got it, Eddie smiled.
You know something, Ben said. You guys are really cool.
Eddie looked more than embarrassed. He looked almost nervous.
Bill is, he said, and started off.
Ben watched him go down Jackson Street and then turn toward home. 3 blocks up the street, he saw 3 all-too-familiar figures standing at the bus stop on the corner of Jackson and Main. They were mostly turned away from Ben, which was damned lucky for him. He ducked behind a hedge, his heart beating hard. 5 minutes later, the Derry Newport Haven interurban bus pulled up. Henry and his friends pitched their butts into the street and swung aboard. Ben waited until the bus was out of sight and then hurried home. 8. That night, a terrible thing happened to Bill Denbro. It happened for the second time. His mom and dad were downstairs watching TV, not talking much, sitting at either end of the couch like bookends. There had been a time when the TV room opening off the kitchen would have been full of talk and laughter, sometimes so much of both you couldn't hear the TV at all.
Shut up, Georgie, Bill would roar. Stop hogging all the popcorn and I will, George would return. Ma, make Bill give me the popcorn.
Bill give him the popcorn.
George, don't call me Ma. Ma's the sound a sheep makes.
Or his dad would tell a joke and they would all laugh, even Mom. George didn't always get the jokes, Bill knew, but he laughed because everyone else was laughing. In those days, his mom and dad had also been bookends on the couch, but he and George had been the books. Bill had tried to be a book between them while they were watching TV since George's death, but it was cold work. They sent the cold out from both directions, and Bill's defroster was simply not big enough to cope with it. He had to leave because that kind of cold always froze his cheeks and made his eyes water. "Will want to hear a joke I heard today in school?" he had tried once, some months ago. Silence from them. On television, a criminal was begging his brother, who was a priest, to hide him. Bill's dad glanced up from the true he was looking at and glanced at Bill with mild surprise. Then he looked back down at the magazine again. There was a picture of a hunter sprawled in a snowbank and staring up at a huge snarling polar bear. "Mauled by the killer from the White Wastes" was the name of the article. Bill had thought, "I know where there's some White Wastes, right between my dad and mom on this couch." His mother had never looked up at all. "It's about how many Frenchmen it takes to ruin a light bulb." Bill plunged ahead. He felt a fine mist of sweat spring out upon his forehead, as it sometimes did in school when he knew the teacher had ignored him as long as she safely could and must soon call on him. His voice was too loud, but he couldn't seem to lower it. The words echoed in his head like crazy chimes, echoing, jamming up, spilling out again.
Do you know how many?
"One to hold the bulb and four to turn the house," Zach Denbro said absently, and turned the page of his magazine.
"Did you say something, dear?"
his mother asked, and on Four Star Playhouse, the brother who was a priest told the brother who was a hoodlum to turn himself in and pray for forgiveness. Bill sat there, sweating but cold, so cold. It was cold because he wasn't really the only book between those two ends. Georgie was still there, only now it was a Georgie he couldn't see. A Georgie who never demanded the popcorn or hollered that Bill was pinching. This new version of George never cut up Dickens. It was a one-armed Georgie who was palely, thoughtfully silent in the Motorola's shadowy white and blue glow. And perhaps it was not from his parents, but from George that the big chill was really coming. Perhaps it was George who was the real killer from the White Wastes. Finally, Bill had fled from that cold, invisible brother and into his room, where he lay face down on his bed and cried into his pillow. George's room was just as it had been on the day he died. Zach had put a bunch of George's toys into a carton one day about 2 weeks after he was buried, meaning them for the Goodwill or the Salvation Army or someplace like that, Bill supposed. Sharon Denbro had spotted him coming out with the box in his arms, and her hands had flown to her head like startled white birds and plunged themselves deep into her hair, where they locked themselves into pulling fists. Bill had seen this and had fallen against the wall, the strength suddenly running out of his legs. His mother looked as mad as Elsa Lanchester in The Bride of Frankenstein. "Don't you dare take his things," she had screeched. Zach flinched and then took the box of toys back into George's room without a word. He even put them back in exactly the same places from which he had taken them. Bill came in and saw his father kneeling by George's bed, which his mother still changed, although only once a week now instead of twice, with his head on his hairy muscular forearms. Bill saw his father was crying, and this increased his terror. A frightening possibility suddenly occurred to him. Maybe sometimes things didn't just go wrong and then stop. Maybe sometimes they just kept going wronger and wronger until everything was totally fucked up. Dad? "Go on, Bill," his father said. His voice was muffled and shaking. His back went up and down. Bill badly wanted to touch his father's back to see if perhaps his hand might be able to still that restless heaving. He did not quite dare. "Go on, buzz off." He left and went creeping along the upstairs hall, hearing his mother doing her own crying down in the kitchen. The sound was shrill and helpless. Bill thought, why are they crying so far apart? And then he shoved the thought away. 9. On the first night of summer vacation, Bill went into Georgie's room. His heart was beating heavily in his chest, and his legs felt stiff and awkward with tension. He came to George's room often, but that didn't mean he liked it in here. The room was so full of George's presence that it felt haunted.
He came in and couldn't help thinking that the closet door might creak open at any moment, and there would be Georgie among the shirts and pants still neatly hung in there. A Georgie dressed in a rain slicker covered with red splotches and streaks. A rain slicker with one dangling yellow arm. George's eyes would be blank and terrible, the eyes of a zombie in a horror movie. When he came out of the closet, his galoshes would make squishy sounds as he walked across the room toward where Bill sat on his bed, a frozen block of terror. If the power had gone out some evening while he sat here on George's bed, looking at the pictures on George's wall or the models on top of George's dresser, he felt sure a heart attack, probably fatal, would ensue in the next 10 seconds or so. But he went anyway. Warring with his terror of George the ghost was a mute and grasping need, a hunger, to somehow get over George's death and find a decent way to go on. Not to forget George, but somehow to find a way to make him not so fucking gruesome. He understood that his parents were not succeeding very well with that, and if he was going to do it for himself, he would have to do it by himself. Nor was it just for himself that he came. He came for Georgie as well. He had loved George, and for brothers they had gotten along pretty well. Oh, they had their pissy moments, Bill giving George a good old Indian rope burn, George tattling on Bill when Bill snuck downstairs after lights out and ate the rest of the lemon cream frosting. But mostly they got along. Bad enough that George should be dead. For him to turn George into some kind of horror monster, that was even worse. He missed the little kid, that was the truth. Missed his voice, his laughter, missed the way George's eyes sometimes tipped confidently up to his own, sure that Bill would have whatever answers were required. And one surpassingly odd thing, there were times when he felt he loved George best in his fear. Because even in his fear, his uneasy feelings that a zombie George might be lurking in the closet or under the bed, he could remember loving George better in here, and George loving him. In his effort to reconcile these two emotions, his love and his terror, Bill felt that he was closest to finding where final acceptance lay. These were not things of which he could have spoken. To his mind, the ideas were nothing but an incoherent jumble. But his warm and desiring heart understood, and that was all that mattered. Sometimes he looked through George's books, sometimes he sifted through George's toys. He hadn't looked in George's photograph album since last December. Now, on the night after meeting Ben Hanscom, Bill opened the door of George's closet, steeling himself, as always, to meet the sight of Georgie himself, standing in his bloody slicker amid the hanging clothes, expecting as always to see one pallid, fish-fingered hand come pistoning out of the dark to grip his arm, and took the album down from the top shelf. My photographs. The gold script on the front read. Below, scotch taped on, the tape was now slightly yellow and peeling, the carefully printed words, George Elmer Denbrough, age 6. Bill took it back to the bed Georgie had slept in, his heart beating heavier than ever. He couldn't tell what had made him get the photograph album down again, after what had happened in December. A second look, that's all, just to convince yourself that it wasn't real the first time. That the first time was just your head playing a trick on itself. Well, it was an idea anyway. It might even be true. But Bill suspected it was just the album itself. It held a certain mad fascination for him. What he had seen, or what he thought he had seen. He opened the album now. It was filled with pictures George had gotten his mother, father, aunts, and uncles to give him. George didn't care if they were pictures of people and places he knew or not. It was the idea of photography itself which fascinated him. When he had been unsuccessful at pestering anyone into giving him new photos to mount, he would sit cross-legged on his bed where Bill was sitting now and look at the old ones, turning the pages carefully, studying the black and white Kodaks. Here was their mother when she was young and impossibly gorgeous. Here, their father, no more than 18, one of a trio of smiling, rifle-toting young men standing over the open-eyed corpse of a deer. Uncle Hoyt standing on some rocks and holding up a pickerel. Aunt Fortuna, at the dairy agricultural fair, kneeling proudly beside a basket of tomatoes she had raised. An old Buick automobile, a church, a house, a road that went from somewhere to somewhere.
All these pictures, snapped by lost somebodies for lost reasons, locked up here in a dead boy's album of photographs. Here Bill saw himself at 3, propped up in a hospital bed with a turban of bandages covering his hair. Bandages went down his cheeks and under his fractured jaw. He had been struck by a car in the parking lot of the A&P on Center Street. He remembered very little of his hospital stay, only that they had given him ice cream milkshakes through a straw, and his head had ached dreadfully for 3 days. Here was the whole family on the lawn of the house, Bill standing by his mother and holding her hand, and George, only a baby, sleeping in Zach's arms. And here, it wasn't the end of the book, but it was the last page that mattered, because the following ones were all blank. The final picture was George's school picture, taken in October of last year, less than 10 days before he died. In it, George was wearing a crewneck shirt. His flyaway hair was slicked down with water. He was grinning, revealing 2 empty slots in which new teeth would never grow. Unless they keep on growing after you die, Bill thought, and shuddered. He looked at the picture fixedly for some time, and was about to close the book, when what had happened in December happened again. George's eyes rolled in the picture. They turned up to meet Bill's own. George's artificial say-cheese smile turned into a horrid leer. His right eye drooped closed in a wink. "See you soon, Bill. In my closet. Maybe tonight." Bill threw the book across the room. He clapped his hands over his mouth. The book struck the wall and fell to the floor, open. The pages turned, although there was no draft. The book opened itself to that awful picture again, the picture which said, "School Friends, 1957-58, beneath it. Blood began to flow from the picture. Bill sat frozen, his tongue a swelling, choking lump in his mouth, his skin crawling, his hair lifting. He wanted to scream, but the tiny whimpering sounds crawling out of his throat seemed to be the best he could manage. The blood flowed across the page and began to drip onto the floor. Bill fled the room, slamming the door behind him. Chapter 6. One of the Missing. A Tale from the Summer of 58. 1. They weren't all found. No, they weren't all found. And from time to time, wrong assumptions were made. 2. From the Derry News, June 21st, 1958. Page 1. Missing boy prompts new fears. Edward L. Corcoran of 73 Charter Street, Derry, was reported missing last night by his mother, Monica Macklin, and his stepfather, Richard P. Macklin. The Corcoran boy is 10. His disappearance has prompted new fears that Derry's young people are being stalked by a killer. Mrs. Macklin said the boy had been missing since June 19th, when he failed to return home from school after the last day of classes before summer vacation. When asked why they had delayed over 24 hours before reporting their son's absence, Mr. and Mrs. Macklin refused comment. Police Chief Richard Borton also declined comment, but a police department source told the news that the Corcoran boy's relationship with his stepfather was not a good one, and that he had spent nights out of the house before. The source speculated that the boy's final grades may have played a part in the boy's failure to turn up. Derry School Superintendent Harold Metcalf declined comment on the Corcoran boys' grades, pointing out they are not a matter of public record. "I hope the disappearance of this boy will not cause unnecessary fears," Chief Borton said last night. "The mood of the community is understandably uneasy, but I want to emphasize that we log 30 to 50 missing persons reports on minors each and every year. Most turn up alive and well within a week of the initial report. This will be the case with Edward Corcoran, God willing." Borton also reiterated his conviction that the murders of George Denbrough, Betty Ripsom, Cheryl LaMonica, Matthew Clements, and Veronica Grogan were not the work of one person. "There are essential differences in each crime," Borton said, but declined to elaborate. He said that local police, working in close cooperation with the Maine State Attorney General's office, are still following up a number of leads. Asked in a telephone interview last night how good these leads are, Chief Borton replied, "Very good." Asked if an arrest in any of the crimes was expected soon, Borton declined comment. From the Derry News, June 22nd, 1958, page 1. Court orders surprise exhumation. In a bizarre new twist to the disappearance of Edward Corcoran, Derry District Court Judge Earhart K. Moulton ordered the exhumation of Corcoran's younger brother, Dorsey, late yesterday. The court order followed a joint request from the county attorney and the county medical examiner. Dorsey Corcoran, who also lived with his mother and stepfather at 73 Charter Street, died of what were reported to be accidental causes in May of 1957. The boy was brought into the Derry Home Hospital suffering from multiple fractures, including a fractured skull. Richard P. Macklin, the boy's stepfather, was the admitting person. He stated that Dorsey Corcoran had been playing on a stepladder in the garage and had apparently fallen from the top. The boy died without recovering consciousness 3 days later. Edward Corcoran, 10, was reported missing late Wednesday. Asked if either Mr. or Mrs. Macklin was under suspicion in either the younger boy's death or the older boy's disappearance, Chief Richard Borton declined comment. From the Derry News, June 24, 1958. Page 1. Macklin arrested in beating death. Under suspicion in unsolved disappearance. Chief Richard Borton of the Derry Police called a news conference yesterday to announce that Richard P. Macklin of 73 Charter Street had been arrested and charged with the murder of his stepson, Dorsey Corcoran. The Corcoran boy died in Derry Home Hospital of reported accidental causes on May 31st of last year. The medical examiner's report shows that the boy was badly beaten, Borton said. Although Macklin claimed the boy had fallen from a stepladder while playing in the garage, Borton said the county medical examiner's report showed that Dorsey Corcoran was severely beaten with some blunt instrument. When asked what sort of instrument, Borton said, "It might have been a hammer. Right now the important thing is the medical examiner's conclusion that this boy was struck repeated blows with some object hard enough to break his bones." The wounds, particularly those in the skull, are not at all consistent with those which might be incurred in a fall. Dorsey Corcoran was beaten within an inch of his life and then dumped off at the home hospital emergency room to die. Asked if the doctors who treated the Corcoran boy might have been derelict in their duty when it came to reporting either an incidence of child abuse or the actual cause of death, Borton said, "They will have serious questions to answer when Mr. Macklin comes to trial." Asked for an opinion on how these developments might bear on the recent disappearance of Dorsey Corcoran's older brother, Edward, reported missing by Richard and Monica Macklin 4 days ago, Chief Borton answered, "I think it looks much more serious than we first supposed, don't you?" From the Derry News, June 25, 1958, page 2. Teacher says Edward Corcoran often bruised. Henrietta Dumont, who teaches fifth grade at Derry Elementary School on Jackson Street, said that Edward Corcoran, who has now been missing for nearly a week, often came to school covered with bruises. Mrs. Dumont, who has taught one of Derry's two fifth grade classes since the end of World War II, said that the Corcoran boy came to school one day about 3 weeks before his disappearance with both eyes nearly closed shut. When I asked him what happened, he said his father had taken him up for not eating his supper. When asked why she had not reported a beating of such obvious severity, Mrs. Dumont said, "This isn't the first time I've seen such a thing as this in my career as a teacher. The first few times I had a student with a parent who was confusing beatings with discipline, I tried to do something about it. I was told by the assistant principal, Gwendolyn Rayburn, in those days, to stay out of it. She told me that when school employees get involved in cases of suspected child abuse, it always comes back to haunt the school department at tax appropriation time. I went to the principal and he told me to forget it or I would be reprimanded. I asked him if a reprimand in a matter like that would go on my record. He said a reprimand did not have to be on a teacher's record. I got the message." Asked if the attitude in the Derry school system remained the same now, Mrs. Dumont said, "Well, what does it look like in light of this current situation? And I might add that I would not be speaking to you now if I hadn't retired at the end of this school year." Mrs. Dumont went on, "Since this thing came out, I get down on my knees every night and pray that Eddie Corcoran just got fed up with that beast of a stepfather and ran away. I pray that when he reads in the paper or hears on the news that Macklin has been locked up, Eddie will come home." In a brief telephone interview, Monica Macklin hotly refuted Mrs. Dumont's charges. "Rich never beat Dorsey, and he never beat Eddie either," she said.
I'm telling you that right now, and when I die, I'll stand at the throne of judgment and look God right in the eye and tell him the same thing. From the Derry News, June 28, 1958, page 2. Daddy had to take me up 'cause I'm bad, Tot told nursery teacher before beating death. A local nursery school teacher, who declined to be identified, told a news reporter yesterday that young Dorsey Corcoran came to his twice-weekly nursery school class with bad sprains of his right thumb and three fingers of his right hand less than a week before his death in a purported garage accident. It was hurting him enough so that the poor little guy couldn't color his Mr. Do safety poster, the teacher said. The fingers were swelled up like sausages. When I asked Dorsey what happened, he said that his father, stepfather Richard P. Macklin, had bent his fingers back because he had walked across a floor his mother had just washed and waxed. Daddy had to take me up 'cause I'm bad, was the way he put it. I felt like crying, looking at his poor dear fingers. He really wanted to color his poster like the other children. So I gave him some baby aspirin and let him color while the others were having story time. He loved to color the Mr. Do posters. That was what he liked best. And now I'm so glad I was able to help him have a little happiness that day. When he died, it never crossed my mind to think it was anything but an accident. I guess at first I thought he must have fallen because he couldn't grip very well with that hand. Now I think I just couldn't believe an adult could do such a thing to a little person. I know better now. I wish to God I didn't. Dorsey Corcoran's older brother, Edward, 10, is still missing. From his cell in Derry County Jail, Richard Macklin continues to deny any part in either the death of his younger stepson or the disappearance of the older boy. From the Derry News, June 30, 1958, page 5. Macklin questioned in deaths of Grogan, Clements. Produces unshakable alibis, source claims. From the Derry News, July 6, 1958, page 1. Macklin to be charged only with murder of stepson Dorsey, Borton says. Edward Corcoran still missing. From the Derry News, July 24, 1958, page 1. Weeping stepfather confesses to bludgeon death of stepson. In a dramatic development in the district court trial of Richard Macklin for the murder of his stepson, Dorsey Corcoran, Macklin broke down under the stern cross-examination of County Attorney Bradley Whitson and admitted he had beaten the 4-year-old boy to death with a recoilless hammer, which he then buried at the far end of his wife's vegetable garden before taking the boy to Derry Home Hospital's emergency room. The courtroom was stunned and silent as the sobbing Macklin, who had previously admitted beating both of his stepsons occasionally, if they had it coming, for their own good, poured out his story. I don't know what came over me. I saw he was climbing on the damn ladder again, and I grabbed the hammer from the bench where it was laying, and I just started to use it on him. I didn't mean to kill him. With God as my witness, I never meant to kill him. Did he say anything to you before he passed out? Whitson asked. He said, "Stop, Daddy, I'm sorry. I love you," Macklin replied. Did you stop? Eventually, Macklin said. He then began to weep in such a hysterical manner that Judge Earhart Moulton declared the court in recess. From the Derry News, September 18, 1958, page 16. Where is Edward Corcoran? His stepfather, sentenced to a term of 2 to 10 years in Shawshank State Prison for the murder of his 4-year-old brother Dorsey, continues to claim he has no idea where Edward Corcoran is. His mother, who has instituted divorce proceedings against Richard P. Macklin, says she thinks her soon-to-be ex-husband is lying. Is he? I, for one, really don't think so, says Father Ashley O'Brien, who serves the Catholic prisoners at Shawshank. Macklin began taking instruction in the Catholic faith shortly after beginning his prison term, and Father O'Brien has spent a good deal of time with him. He is sincerely sorry for what he has done, Father O'Brien goes on, adding that when he initially asked Macklin why he wanted to be a Catholic, Macklin replied, "I hear they have an act of contrition, and I need to do a lot of that, or else I'll go to hell when I die." He knows what he did to the younger boy, Father O'Brien said. If he also did something to the older one, he doesn't remember it. As far as Edward goes, he believes his hands are clean.
How clean Macklin's hands are in the matter of his stepson Edward is a question which continues to trouble Derry residents. But he has been convincingly cleared of the other child murders which have taken place here. He was able to produce ironclad alibis for the first three, and he was in jail when seven others were committed in late June, July, and August. All 10 murders remain unsolved. In an exclusive interview with the news last week, Macklin again asserted that he knows nothing of Edward Corcoran's whereabouts. "I beat them both," he said in a painful monologue, which was often halted by bouts of weeping. "I love them, but I beat them. I don't know why, any more than I know why Monica let me, or why she covered up for me after Dorsey died. I guess I could have killed Eddie as easy as I did Dorsey, but I swear before God and Jesus and all the saints of heaven that I didn't. I know how it looks, but I didn't do it. I think he just ran away. If he did, that's one thing I've got to thank God for." Asked if he is aware of any gaps in his memory, if he could have killed Edward and then blocked it out of his mind, Macklin replied, "I ain't aware of any gaps. I know only too well what I did. I've given my life to Christ, and I'm going to spend the rest of it trying to make up for it." From the Derry News, January 27, 1960, page 1. "Body not that of Corcoran youth," Borton announces. Police Chief Richard Borton told reporters early today that the badly decomposed body of a boy about the age of Edward Corcoran, who disappeared from his Derry home in June of 1958, is definitely not that of the missing youth. The body was found in Amesford, Massachusetts, buried in a gravel pit. Both Maine and Massachusetts state police at first theorized that the body might be that of the Corcoran boy, believing that he might have been picked up by a child molester after running away from the Charter Street home where his younger brother had been beaten and killed. Dental charts showed conclusively that the body found in Amesford was not that of the Corcoran youth, who has now been missing for 19 months. From the Portland Press Herald, July 19, 1967, page 3. Convicted murderer commits suicide in Falmouth. Richard P. Macklin, who was convicted of the murder of his four-year-old stepson 9 years ago, was found dead in his small third-floor Falmouth apartment late yesterday afternoon. The parolee, who had lived and worked quietly in Falmouth since his release from Shawshank State Prison in 1964, was an apparent suicide. The note he left indicates an extremely confused state of mind, Assistant Falmouth Police Chief Brandon K. Roche said. He refused to divulge the note's contents, but a police department source said it consisted of two sentences. "I saw Eddie last night. He was dead." The Eddie referred to may well have been Macklin's stepson, brother of the boy Macklin was convicted of killing in 1958. It was the disappearance of Edward Corcoran which eventually led to Macklin's conviction for the beating death of Edward's younger brother, Dorsey. The elder boy has been missing for 9 years. In a brief court proceeding in 1966, the boy's mother had her son declared legally dead so she could enter into possession of Edward Corcoran's savings account. The account contained a sum of $16. 3. Eddie Corcoran was dead, all right. He died on the night of June 19th, and his stepfather had nothing at all to do with it. He died as Ben Hanscom sat home watching TV with his mother, as Eddie Kasbrak's mother anxiously felt Eddie's forehead for signs of her favorite ailment, phantom fever, as Beverly Marsh's stepfather, a gent who bore, in temperament at least, a remarkable resemblance to Eddie and Dorsey Corcoran's stepfather, lifted a high-stepping kick into the girl's derriere and told her to get out there and dry those goddamn dishes like your mummer told you. As Mike Hanlon got yelled at by some high school boys, one of whom would some years later sire that fine upstanding young homophobe, John Webby Garten, passing in an old Dodge while Mike pulled weeds out of the garden beside the small Hanlon home out on Witcham Road, not far from the farm owned by the Henry Bowers' crazy father, as Richie Tozier was sneaking a look at the half-undressed girls in a copy of Gem he had found at the bottom of his father's socks and underwear drawer and getting a regular good boner, and as Bill Denbro was throwing his dead brother's photograph album across the room in horrified unbelief. Although none of them would remember doing so later, all of them looked up at the exact moment Eddie Corcoran died,
as if hearing some distant cry. The news had been absolutely right about one thing. Eddie's rank card was just bad enough to make him afraid to go home and face his stepdad. Also, his mother and the old man were fighting a lot this month. That made things even worse. When they got going at it hot and heavy, his mother shouted a lot of mostly incoherent accusations. His stepdad responded to these first with grunts, then yells to shut up, and finally with the enraged bellows of a boar which has gotten a quiver of porcupine needles in its snout. Eddie had never seen the old man use his fists on her, though. Eddie didn't think he quite dared. He had saved his fists for Eddie and Dorsey in the old days, and now that Dorsey was dead, Eddie got his little brother's share as well as his own. These shouting matches came and went in cycles. They were most common at the end of the month when the bills came in. A policeman, called by a neighbor, might drop by once or twice when things were at their worst and tell them to tone it down. Usually that ended it. His mother was apt to give the cop the finger and dare him to take her in, but his stepdad rarely said boo. His stepdad was afraid of the cops, Eddie thought. He lay low during these periods of stress. It was wiser. If you didn't think so, just look at what had happened to Dorsey. Eddie didn't know the specifics and didn't want to, but he had an idea about Dorsey. He thought that Dorsey had been in the wrong place at the wrong time, the garage on the last day of the month. They told Eddie that Dorsey fell off the stepladder in the garage. If I told him once to stay off in it, I told him 60 times, his stepdad had said. But his mother wouldn't look at him except by accident, and when their eyes did meet, Eddie had seen a frightened, ratty little gleam in hers that he didn't like. The old man just sat there silently at the kitchen table with a quart of Rheingold, looking at nothing from beneath his heavy, lowering eyebrows. Eddie kept out of his reach. When his stepfather was bellowing, he was usually, not always, but usually, all right. It was when he stopped that you had to be careful. 2 nights ago, he had thrown a chair at Eddie when Eddie got up to see what was on the other TV channel. Just picked up one of the tubular aluminum kitchen chairs, swept it back over his head, and let it fly. It hit Eddie in the butt and knocked him over. His butt still ached, but he knew it could have been worse. It could have been his head. Then there had been the night when the old man had suddenly gotten up and rubbed a handful of mashed potatoes into Eddie's hair for no reason at all. One day last September, Eddie had come in from school and foolishly allowed the screen door to slam shut behind him while his stepdad was taking a nap. Macklin came out of the bedroom in his billowy boxer shorts, hair standing up in corkscrews, cheeks grizzled with 2 days of weekend beard, breath grizzled with 2 days of weekend beer. "There now, Eddie," he said, "I got to take you up for slamming that fucking door." In Rich Macklin's lexicon, taking you up was a euphemism for beating the shit out of you, which was what he then did to Eddie. Eddie had lost consciousness when the old man threw him into the front hall. His mother had mounted a pair of low coat hooks out there, especially for him and Dorsey to hang their coats on. These hooks had rammed hard steel fingers into Eddie's lower back, and that was when he passed out. When he came to 10 minutes later, he heard his mother yelling that she was going to take Eddie to the hospital and he couldn't stop her. "After what happened to Dorsey," his stepdad had responded, "you want to go to jail, woman?" That was the end of her talk about the hospital. She helped Eddie into his room, where he lay shivering on his bed, his forehead beaded with sweat. The only time he left the room during the next 3 days was when they were both gone. Then he would hobble slowly into the kitchen, groaning softly, and get his stepdad's whiskey from under the sink. A few nips dulled the pain. The pain was mostly gone by the fifth day, but he had pissed blood for almost 2 weeks. And the hammer wasn't in the garage anymore. What about that? What about that, friends and neighbors? Oh, the craftsman hammer, the ordinary hammer, was still there. It was the Scotty recoilless which was missing. His stepdad's special hammer, the one he and Dorsey had been forbidden to touch. "If one of you touches that baby," he had told them the day he bought it, "you'll both be wearing your guts for earmuffs." Dorsey had asked timidly if that hammer was very expensive. The old man told him he was damn tooting. He said it was filled with ball bearings and you couldn't make it bounce back up no matter how hard you brought it down. Now it was gone. Eddie's grades weren't the best because he had missed a lot of school since his mother's remarriage, but he was not a stupid boy by any means. He thought he knew what had happened to the Scotty recoilless hammer. He thought maybe his stepfather had used it on Dorsey and then buried it in the garden or maybe thrown it in the canal. It was the sort of thing that happened frequently in the horror comics Eddie read, the ones he kept on the top shelf of his closet. He walked closer to the canal, which rippled between its concrete sides like oiled silk. A swatch of moonlight glimmered across its dark surface in a boomerang shape. He sat down, swinging his sneakers idly against the concrete in an irregular tattoo. The last 6 weeks had been quite dry, and the water flowed past perhaps 9 feet below the worn soles of his sneakers. But if you looked closely at the canal's sides, you could read the various levels to which it sometimes rose quite easily. The concrete was stained a dark brown just above the water's current level. This brown stain slowly faded to yellow, then to a color that was almost white at the level where the heels of Eddie's sneakers made contact when he swung them. The water flowed smoothly and silently out of a concrete arch that was cobbled on the inside, past the place where Eddie sat, and then down to the covered wooden footbridge between Basie Park and Derry High School. The bridge's sides and plank footing, even the beams under the roof, were covered with an intaglio of initials, phone numbers, and declarations. Declarations of love, declarations that so-and-so was willing to suck or blow, declarations that those discovered sucking or blowing would lose their foreskins or have their assholes plugged with hot tar. Occasional eccentric declarations that defied definition. One that Eddie had puzzled over all this spring read, "Save Russian Jews. Collect valuable prizes." What exactly did that mean? Anything? And did it matter? Eddie didn't go into the Kissing Bridge tonight. He had no urge to cross over to the high school side. He thought he would probably sleep in the park, maybe in the dead leaves under the bandstand, but for now it was fine just to sit here. He liked it in the park, and came often when he had to think. Sometimes there were people making out in the groves of trees which dotted the park, but Eddie left them alone and they left him alone. He had heard lurid stories in the playground at school about the queers that cruised in Basie Park after sundown, and he accepted these stories without question, but he himself had never been bothered. The park was a peaceful place, and he thought the best part of it was right here where he was sitting. He liked it in the middle of summer, when the water was so low it chuckled over the stones and actually broke up into isolated streamlets that twisted and turned and sometimes came together again. He liked it in late March or early April, just after ice out, when he would sometimes stand by the canal, too cold to sit then, your ass would freeze, for an hour or more. The hood of his old parka, now 2 years too small for him, pulled up, his hands plunged into his pockets, unaware that his skinny body was shivering and shaking. The canal had a terrible, irresistible power in the week or two after the ice went out. He was fascinated by the way the water boiled whitely out of the cobbled arch and roared past him, bearing sticks and branches and all manner of human trash along with it. More than once he had envisioned walking beside the canal in March with his stepdad and giving the bastard a great big motherfucking push. He would scream and fall in, his arms pinwheeling for balance, and Eddie would stand on the concrete parapet and watch him carried off downstream, his head a black bobbing shape in the middle of the unruly white-capped current. He would stand there, yes, and he would cup his hands around his mouth and scream, "That was for Dorsey, you rotten cocksucker! When you get down to hell, tell the devil the last thing you ever heard was me telling you to pick on somebody your own size." It would never happen, of course, but it was an absolutely grand fantasy. A grand dream to dream as you sat here by the canal. A hand closed around Eddie's foot. He had been looking across the canal toward the school, smiling a sleepy and rather beautiful smile as he imagined his stepfather being carried off in the violent rip of the spring runoff, being carried out of his life forever. The soft yet strong grip startled him so much that he almost lost his balance and tumbled into the canal. "It's one of the queers the big kids are always talking about," he thought, and then he looked down. His mouth dropped open. Urine spilled hotly down his legs and stained his jeans black in the moonlight. It wasn't a queer. It was Dorsey. It was Dorsey as he had been buried. Dorsey in his blue blazer and gray pants, only now the blazer was in muddy tatters. Dorsey's shirt was yellow rags. Dorsey's pants clung wetly to legs as thin as broomsticks. And Dorsey's head was horribly slumped, as if it had been caved in at the back and consequently pushed up in the front. Dorsey was grinning.
"Eddie!"
his dead brother croaked, just like one of the dead people who are always coming back from the grave in the horror comics. Dorsey's grin widened. Yellow teeth gleamed, and somewhere way back in that darkness, things seemed to be squirming.
"Eddie! I came to see you, Eddie!"
Eddie tried to scream. Waves of gray shock rolled over him, and he had the curious sensation that he was floating. But it was not a dream. He was awake. The hand on his sneaker was as white as a trout's belly. His brother's bare feet clung somehow to the concrete. Something had bitten one of Dorsey's heels off.
"Come on down, Eddie."
Eddie couldn't scream. His lungs didn't have enough air in them to manage a scream. He got out a curious, reedy, moaning sound. Anything louder seemed beyond him. That was all right. In a second or two, his mind would snap, and after that, nothing would matter. Dorsey's hand was small but implacable. Eddie's buttocks were sliding over the concrete to the edge of the canal. Still making that reedy moaning sound, he reached behind himself and grabbed the concrete edging and yanked himself backward. He felt the hand slide away momentarily, heard an angry hiss, and had time to think, "That's not Dorsey. I don't know what it is, but it's not Dorsey." Then adrenaline flooded his body and he was crawling away, trying to run even before he was on his feet, his breath coming in short, shrieky whistles. White hands appeared on the concrete lip of the canal. There was a wet slapping sound. Drops of water flew upward in the moonlight from dead, pallid skin. Now Dorsey's face appeared over the edge. Dim red sparks gleamed in his sunken eyes. His wet hair was plastered to his skull. Mud streaked his cheeks like war paint. Eddie's chest finally unlocked. He hitched in breath and turned it into a scream. He got to his feet and ran. He ran looking back over his shoulder, needing to see where Dorsey was, and as a result he ran smack into a large elm tree. It felt as if someone, his old man for instance, had set off a dynamite charge in his left shoulder. Stars shot and corkscrewed through his head. He fell at the base of the tree as if pole-axed, blood trickling from his left temple. He swam in the waters of semi-consciousness for perhaps 90 seconds. Then he managed to gain his feet again. A groan escaped him as he tried to raise his left arm. It didn't want to come. Felt all numb and far away. So he raised his right and rubbed his fiercely aching head. Then he remembered why he had happened to run full tilt into the elm tree in the first place and looked around. There was the edge of the canal, white as bone and straight as string in the moonlight. No sign of the thing from the canal, if there ever had been a thing. He continued turning, working his way slowly through a complete 360 degrees. Basie Park was silent and as still as a black and white photograph. Weeping willows draggled their thin, tenebrous arms, and anything could be standing, slumped and insane, within their shelter. Eddie began to walk, trying to look everywhere at once. His sprained shoulder throbbed in painful sync with his heartbeat.
"Eddie," the breeze moaned through the trees. "Don't you want to see me, Eddie?"
He felt flabby corpse fingers caress the side of his neck. He whirled, his hands going up. As his feet tangled together and he fell, he saw that it had only been willow fronds moving in the breeze. He got up again. He wanted to run, but when he tried, another dynamite charge went off in his shoulder and he had to stop. He knew somehow that he should be getting over his fright by now, calling himself a stupid little baby who got spooked by a reflection or maybe fell asleep without knowing it and had a bad dream. That wasn't happening, though. Quite the reverse, in fact. His heart was now beating so fast he could no longer distinguish the separate thuds, and he felt sure it would soon burst in terror. He couldn't run, but when he got out of the willows, he did manage a limping jog trot. He fixed his eyes on the streetlight that marked the park's main gate. He headed in that direction, managing a little more speed, thinking, "I'll make it to the light, and that's all right. I'll make it to the light, and that's all right. Bright light, no more fright. Up all night, what a sight." Something was following him. Eddie could hear it bludgeoning its way through the willow grove. If he turned, he would see it. It was gaining. He could hear its feet, a kind of shuffling, squelching stride. But he would not look back. No, he would look ahead at the light. The light was all right. He would just continue his flight to the light, and he was almost there, almost... The smell was what made him look back. The overwhelming smell, as if fish had been left to rot in a huge pile that had become carrion slushy in the summer heat. It was the smell of a dead ocean. It wasn't Dorsey after him now. It was the creature from the Black Lagoon. The thing's snout was long and pleated. Green fluid dripped from black gashes like vertical mouths in its cheeks. Its eyes were white and jelly-like. Its webbed fingers were tipped with claws like razors. Its respiration was bubbly and deep, the sound of a diver with a bad regulator. As it saw Eddie looking, its green-black lips wrinkled back from huge fangs in a dead and vacant smile. It shambled after him, dripping, and Eddie suddenly understood. It meant to take him back to the canal, to carry him down into the dank blackness of the canal's underground passage, to eat him there. Eddie put on a burst of speed. The arc sodium light at the gate drew closer. He could see its halo of bugs and moths. A truck went by, headed for Route 2, the driver working his way up through the gears, and it crossed Eddie's desperate, terrified mind that he could be drinking coffee from a paper cup and listening to a Buddy Holly tune on the radio, completely unaware that less than 200 yards away there was a boy who might be dead in another 20 seconds. The stink, the overwhelming stink of it, gaining all around him. It was a park bench he tripped over. Some kids had casually pushed it over earlier that evening, heading toward their homes at a run to beat the curfew. Its seat poked an inch or two out of the grass, one shade of green on another, almost invisible in the moon-driven dark. The edge of the seat smacked Eddie in the shins, causing a burst of glassy, exquisite pain. His legs flipped out behind him and he thumped into the grass. He looked behind him and saw the creature bearing down, its white poached egg eyes glittering, its scales dripping slime the color of seaweed, the gills up and down, its bulging neck and cheeks opening and closing. "Egg," Eddie croaked. It seemed to be the only noise he could make. "Egg, egg, egg, egg." He crawled now, fingers hooking deep into the turf, his tongue hung out. In the second before the creature's fish-smelling horny hands closed around his throat, a comforting thought came to him. This is a dream. It has to be. There's no real creature, no real Black Lagoon. And even if there was, that was in South America, or the Florida Everglades, or someplace like that. This is only a dream, and I'll wake up in my bed, or maybe in the leaves under the bandstand, and I... Then batrachian hands closed around his neck, and Eddie's hoarse cries were choked off. As the creature turned him over, the chitinous hooks which sprouted from those hands scrawled bleeding marks like calligraphy into his neck. He stared into its glowing white eyes. He felt the webs between its fingers pressing against his throat like constricting bands of living seaweed. His terror-sharpened gaze noted the fin, something like a rooster's comb and something like a horn-pout's poisonous back fin, standing atop the creature's hunched and plated head. As its hands clamped tight, shutting off his air, he was able to see the way the white light from the arc sodium lamp turned a smoky green as it passed through that membranous head fin.
"You're not real,"
Eddie choked, but clouds of grayness were closing in now, and he realized faintly that it was real enough, this creature. It was, after all, killing him. And yet some rationality remained, even until the end. As the creature hooked its claws into the soft meat of his neck, as his carotid artery let go in a warm and painless gout that splashed the thing's reptilian plating, Eddie's hands groped at the creature's back, feeling for a zipper. They fell away only when the creature tore his head from his shoulders with a low, satisfied grunt. And as Eddie's picture of what it was began to fade, it began promptly to change into something else. 4. Unable to sleep, plagued by bad dreams, a boy named Michael Hanlon rose soon after first light on the first full day of summer vacation. The light was pale, bundled up in a low, thick mist that would lift by 8 o'clock, taking the wraps off a perfect summer day. But that was for later, for now the world was all gray and rose, as silent as a cat walking on a carpet.
Mike, dressed in corduroys, a T-shirt, and black high-topped Keds, came downstairs, ate a bowl of Wheaties. He didn't really like Wheaties, but had wanted the free prize in the box, a Captain Midnight Magic Dakota ring. Then hopped on his bike and pedaled toward town, riding on the sidewalks because of the fog. The fog changed everything, made the most ordinary things like fire hydrants and stop signs into objects of mystery. Things both strange and a trifle sinister. You could hear cars but not see them, and because of the fog's odd acoustic quality, you could not tell if they were far or near until you actually saw them come rolling out of the fog with ghost halos of moisture ringing their headlamps. He turned right on Jackson Street, bypassing downtown, and then crossed to Main Street by way of Palmer Lane. And during his short ride down this little byway's one block length, he passed the house where he would live as an adult. He did not look at it. It was just a small two-story dwelling with a garage and a small lawn. It gave off no special vibration to the passing boy who would spend most of his adult life as its owner and only dweller. At Main Street, he turned right and rode up to Basie Park, still wandering, simply riding and enjoying the stillness of the early day. Once inside the main gate, he dismounted his bike, pushed down the kickstand, and walked toward the canal. He was still, as far as he knew, impelled by nothing more than purest whim. Certainly it did not occur to him to think that his dreams of the night before had anything to do with his current course. He did not even remember exactly what his dreams had been, only that one had followed another until he had awakened at 5 o'clock, sweaty but shivering, and with the idea that he ought to eat a fast breakfast and then take a bike ride into town. Here in Basie there was a smell in the fog he didn't like, a sea smell, salty and old. He had smelled it before, of course. In the early morning fogs you could often smell the ocean in Derry, although the coast was 40 miles away. But the smell this morning seemed thicker, more vital, almost dangerous. Something caught his eye. He bent down and picked up a cheap two-blade pocket knife. Someone had scratched the initials EC on the side. Mike looked at it thoughtfully for a moment or two and then pocketed it. Finders keepers, losers weepers. He glanced around. Here, near where he had found the knife, was an overturned park bench. He righted it, setting its iron footings back into the holes they had made over a period of months or years. Beyond the bench he saw a matted place in the grass, and leading away from it, two grooves. The grass was springing back up, but those grooves were still fairly clear. They went in the direction of the canal. And there was blood. The bird, remember the bird, remember the... But he did not want to remember the bird, and so he pushed the thought away. Dogfight, that's all. One of them must have hurt the other one pretty bad. It was a convincing thought by which he was somehow not convinced. Thoughts of the bird kept wanting to come back. The one he had seen out at the Kitchener Ironworks, one Stan Uris never would have found in his bird book. Stop it, just get out of here. But instead of getting out, he followed the grooves. As he did, he made up a little story in his mind. It was a murder story. Here's this kid, out late, see? Out past curfew. The killer gets him. And how does he get rid of the body? Drags it to the canal and dumps it in, of course. Just like an Alfred Hitchcock Presents. The marks he was following could have been made by a dragging pair of shoes or sneakers, he supposed. Mike shivered and looked around uncertainly. The story was somehow a little too real. And suppose that it wasn't a man who did it, but a monster. Like out of a horror comic, or a horror book, or a horror movie, or... a bad dream. A fairy tale or something. He decided he didn't like the story. It was a stupid story. He tried to push it out of his mind, but it wouldn't go. So what? Let it stay. It was dumb. Riding into town this morning had been dumb. Following these two matted grooves in the grass was dumb. His dad would have a lot of chores for him to do around the place today. He ought to get back and start in, or when the hottest part of the afternoon rolled around, he would be up the barn loft pitching hay. Yes, he ought to get back, and that's just what he was going to do. Sure you are, he thought. Want to bet? Instead of going back to his bike and getting on and riding home and starting his chores, he followed the grooves in the grass. There were more drops of drying blood here and there. Not much, though. Not as much as there had been in that matted place back there by the park bench he had set to rights. Mike could hear the canal now, running quiet. A moment later, he saw the concrete edge materialize out of the fog. Here was something else in the grass. My goodness, it's certainly your day for finding things, his mind said with dubious geniality. And then a gull screamed somewhere, and Mike flinched, thinking again of the bird he had seen that day. That day just this spring. Whatever that is in the grass, I don't even want to look at it. And that was oh so very true. But here he was, already bending over it, hands planted just above his knees, to see what it was. A tattered bit of cloth with a drop of blood on it. The seagull screamed again. Mike stared at the bloody scrap of cloth and remembered what had happened to him in the spring. 5. Each year during April and May, the Hanlon farm woke up from its winter doze. Mike would let himself know that spring had come again, not when the first crocuses showed under his mom's kitchen windows, or when the kids started bringing innies and croakers to school, or even when the Washington Senators kicked off the baseball season, usually getting themselves shellacked in the process, but only when his father hollered for Mike to help him push their mongrel truck out of the barn. The front half was an old Model A Ford car, the back end a pickup truck with a tailgate, which was the remainder of the old henhouse door. If the winter hadn't been too cold, the two of them could often get it going by pushing it down the driveway. The truck's cab had no doors, likewise there was no windshield. The seat was half of an old sofa that Will Hanlon had scrounged from the dairy dump. The stick shift ended in a glass doorknob. They would push it down the driveway, one on each side, and when it got rolling good, Will would jump in, turn on the switch, retard the spark, step down on the clutch, punch the shift into first gear with his big hand clamped over the doorknob. Then he would holler, "Put me over the hump." He'd pop the clutch and the old Ford engine would cough, choke, chug, backfire, and sometimes actually start to run, rough at first, then smoothing out. Will would roar down the road toward Rulin Farms, turn around in their driveway. If he had gone the other way, Henry Bowers' crazy father, Butch, probably would have blown his head off with a shotgun. And then roar back, the unmuffled engine blatting stridently while Mike jumped up and down with excitement, cheering, and his mom stood in the kitchen doorway, wiping her hands on a dish towel and pretending a disgust she didn't really feel. Other times, the truck wouldn't roll start, and Mike would have to wait until his father came back from the barn, carrying the crank and muttering under his breath. Mike was quite sure that some of the words so muttered were swears, and he would be a little frightened of his daddy then. It wasn't until much later, during one of those interminable visits to the hospital room where Will Hanlon lay dying, that he found out his father muttered because he was afraid of the crank. Once it had kicked back viciously, flown out of its socket, and torn the side of his mouth open. "Stand back, Mikey," he would say, slipping the crank into its socket at the base of the radiator. And when the A was finally running, he'd say that next year he was going to trade it for a Chevrolet. But he never did. That old A Ford hybrid was still in back of the home place, up to its axles and henhouse tailgate in weeds. When it was running, and Mike was sitting in the passenger seat, smelling hot oil and blue exhaust, excited by the keen breeze that washed in through the glassless hole where the windshield had once been, he would think, "Spring's here again. We're all waking up." And in his soul, he would raise a silent cheer that shook the walls of that mostly cheerful room.